This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Hey there, everyone. We all know racing in hot or even warm conditions presents a different kind of challenge from a race that is a little more comfy cozy. And succeeding in a hotter race takes a lot of prep and a little bit of know-how. And that is what we're covering on the show today. Our first coach joining us to talk about this is Kurt Madden. Kurt is a pioneer of the sport and is a double-digit Kona finisher. He has three top 10 finishes at the Ironman World Championships, is a four-time North American age group champion, and also is a four-time number one world-ranked age group Ironman all-world athlete. Kurt is also a two-time Ultraman World Champion and, in 2019, was inducted into the Ultraman World Championship Hall of Fame. In addition, he has a master's degree in exercise physiology, and he is the head of coach development for TriDot. Coach Kurt, welcome back to the show.
It is just awesome to be back, and I have a sense today that things are going to be heating up just a little bit.
Yes, sir. That is the whole point of the episode. I know where I live in Texas, things are starting to heat up, and so this conversation is right on time. Also with us is TriDot coach Caleb Chapman. Caleb is a longtime TriDot ambassador who began coaching with TriDot in 2023. He works full-time as a controller at Detail Mold and Manufacturing, and trains, races, and coaches as a passion project of sorts. Caleb is a world championship qualifier himself, a TriDot pool school instructor, and an Ironman U certified coach. Caleb, thanks so much for joining us for your very first full-length episode of the TriDot Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. I'm excited to be on a full episode, even if a little nervous.
Yeah, sure. No worries there. Well, Kurt and I know what we're doing, so it's going to go great. So if nothing else, two of the three of us know what we're doing. I am Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation, and then wind things down with our cool down. We are thrilled to have Sailfish as the swim partner of TriDot Training. Sailfish was founded in 2007 by Jan Sibbersen, who was on the national German team and is the fastest swimmer to ever hit the waters of Ironman. The Sailfish mission is to create premium triathlon and open water swim products. They offer swim skins, tri suits, and swim accessories. But the core of this Sailfish product line are their award-winning wetsuits. Known for their outstanding flexibility, balanced buoyancy, and distinguished gliding properties in the water, Sailfish wetsuits are truly made to make you faster. And that certainly has been the case for me. I've swam in many different brands of wetsuits over the years, and my Sailfish is the very first one that I put on, got into the water, and clocked swim splits I had no business hitting on my own. For me, it was truly love at first stroke. With several models and price points, there for sure will be a Sailfish wetsuit that is right for you. Head to sailfish.com to check out all the neoprene goodness and use SFC-TriDot20 at checkout for 20% off your new wetsuit.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Triathlon gear comes into our lives and eventually it goes out of our lives. We buy it, we love it, we use it, and eventually for one reason or another, we move on from it. Sometimes we trash things, sometimes we give things away, sometimes we sell them. Regardless of what you did with it or why you moved on, our warm-up question today is, what is one triathlon-related item that you got rid of but wish you had not? I will go, Caleb, first time on the podcast. What's your answer here, buddy?
I thought this was a pretty good question.
Thanks, Caleb. Thanks.
I had the Form goggles for a while. If you don't know about them, they're really cool. You get an augmented reality that displays your pretty much real-time pace in your goggles while you swim. Yeah. Can also show a bunch of other metrics like how far you've swam, your heart rate, So it's pretty cool. But for whatever reason for me, it didn't really track my pace correctly. So I ended up selling them to another Tri-Dotter. Well, now they've come out with a new version that has a load of new features. It can tell you how what your head position's doing, sighting straight in open water. My only problem is they have a subscription model now, and I have a problem with buying a product and then paying for the subscription.
Totally understand that hesitation with form. I myself am pretty jazzed up about the second edition of the goggles. I have the first edition, so I'll have to see if I can sweet talk somebody at Form into letting me test out one of the second editions of those goggles. But good answer here. Kurt Madden, what is your answer to this question?
Andrew, I want to say, honestly, you did stop me on this one. You did. You had me on the mat. I'm looking up like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get pinned on this one. But I thought through it because I do have think time. But back in the day, if you can imagine, there was a sunglass company called Gargoyles. And I was very fortunate that I was with Nike, but somehow we got a kind of another sponsorship from Gargoyles. So I had every type of Gargoyle sunglasses that you can imagine. And if you know this guy, what's his name? Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yeah.
The Terminator. Yeah. Those glasses right there back in the 80s, those were epic sunglasses to have. And I wish if I could go back in time, I should have saved one pair just for memory. Just to say, wow, those were the best thing to have at the time.
Well, and sunglass fashion in endurance sports has like ebbed and flowed over the years, right? Because like back in the day, there was like the big, huge ones, and then like minimal, you know, Lance Armstrong cycled in the more minimalist models, and now the big, huge ones are back in. And so Kurt, those probably would have come and gone in and out of fashion a couple times, and would probably be a good fit right now at the races. So my answer here. I wish I still had my Garmin Forerunner 920 XT. Longtime triathletes will know that model. That was it either came in black and blue or red and white. It was before they went to like the circle interface. It had like a square watch face. And that one fit me great. Like I just love the features of it. And I do have a newer one. I have the Garmin 965. I got rid of the 920 and got a newer one. The only feature I like on the new one is the fact that I can like push my Spotify playlist to the watch. That admittedly is pretty cool, but everything else, like I like the buttons are different. Like this is totally like old man, get off my lawn, but I can't figure out the buttons. Like I press the wrong button to do anything. Anytime I'm trying to do something, I press the wrong button because I'm so used to the 920 XT. I had it for years. I found the 920 more comfortable on my wrist. The 965, it starts itching my wrist and I have to take it off after wearing it for a couple hours. Whereas I lived in the 920 and I'm actually like at the point where I'm like, can I sell this newer one? And does anybody on planet Earth still have a 920 XT that I can buy? I'm going to be looking into that. So that's my answer here. It actually inspired this question because I was on eBay looking at 920 XTs the other day and thought up this question. We're going to throw this question out to you, our audience. I want to hear what you have to say. Of all the triathlon gear you've had, whether it's a pair of running shoes or something in the water, something for your bike that maybe you had and you sold it and you wish you still had it. Very curious to hear from all the tri gear you've used over the years. What is one thing that you moved on from that you wish you still had?
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Before we get too deep into the show today, I want to give a shout out to our good friends at UCAN. Here at TriDot, we are huge believers in using UCAN to fuel our training and racing. In the crowded field of nutrition companies, what separates UCAN from the pack is the science behind Live Steady, the key ingredient in UCAN products. While most energy powders are filled with sugar or stimulants that cause a spike and crash, UCAN energy powders, powered by Live Steady, deliver a steady release of complex carbs to give you stable blood sugar and provide long-lasting energy. I personally fuel my workouts with the orange-flavored Edge Gel and the unflavored UCAN energy powder. Between their energy mix, energy bars, almond butter, and more, there is definitely a Live Steady product that you will love. So head to their website, ucan.co, and use the code TRIDOT to save 20% on your entire order. Now that code used to be 10%, but the fine folks at UCAN have upped it to 20% for TRIDOT Nation. So once again, that's ucan.co, promo code TRIDOT. All right, at the time we are recording this podcast episode and the time that it is being published, it is late spring, early summer in North America. the temperatures are heating up. I'm sure we have listeners elsewhere in the world who it's wintertime. And sorry, guys, I'm in Texas. It's getting hot. And I wanted to talk about training in the heat. So I brought two of our coaches on to dive into this. And guys, we're going to start right in our biology. I want to hear this. When we are not properly prepared for a hot race, when we don't know all the things we're about to learn, we go to the races, we haven't spent time acclimating to the heat properly before a race, what actually happens to us on race day? What happens in our bodies, and what how can we expect to be impacted by the hotter temperatures of the day? Coach Kurt Madden.
I think all of us can respect the heat. And I know that from my experience, my background in education, especially in exercise physiology, that when you're not prepared, it can be fatal. It can actually be dangerous. You want to think about really kind of the first phase you're going to go into. Think of a car that has a dashboard and you start to see these yellow lights start to flash. And really that's your body saying, I think you're going into heat exhaustion. So what does that really mean? You're losing a lot of fluid. When you lose a lot of fluid, losing the water, you're actually losing those electrolytes. And again, that's through excessive sweating because your body's trying to get cooled down. The other thing that you want to remember too is that many athletes that are maybe older, they're going to struggle a little bit more with the heat. And then some athletes that maybe have high blood pressure, they're going to struggle too. So some people can adapt or some people are just naturally born that they can handle that. But you want to remember that as you're going into that yellow light syndrome of heat exhaustion, you'll know that, wait a minute, my skin, you know, it's kind of cold, it's pale, it's clammy. I'm starting to get muscle cramps. I'm getting dizzy. I'm getting a headache. Because really what's happening, the body just cannot cool itself down. So then you have to ask, okay, what about these electrolytes? Well, the muscles are going to start to cramp up because when you really look at the fine details of a muscle contraction, there's so many moving parts. You need the calcium, you need the sodium, you need the potassium, you need the magnesium. And those are things that really help as they go across that cell membrane. The other thing that you want to remember is think about the blood. To think about the blood as it starts to really start to try to cool the body down, that when you think about just the viscosity, think of motor oil, that it's going to get a lot thicker. And what's going to happen, your heart rate is going to definitely be elevated. And when you look at the plasma, the clear liquid, that's the thing that's going to be impacted. So you have less of that clear stuff in your blood and your heart rate's going to go up. And again, that has water and it's protein, it has electrolytes, and then those waste products. The other thing that you want to remember is once you leave that yellow phase where those yellow lights are flashing, where it's heat exhaustion, now you can actually go into heat stroke, which really becomes fatal. I think all of us have seen that before, that it just does not look good. I mean, the person really, they can just not focus. They've got a really bad headache. They're very confused. There's nauseousness, there's dizziness. The pulse is very, very strong, and chances are they might faint. When that happens, it's going to be fatal. Like that's it. That's going to be terminal. So they've got to get medical help right away. We also want to think about the hypothalamus in the brain, that when you start to think about what's the mothership that's controlling all this, that hypothalamus really helps control just the body temperature. And that is really key. I know years ago when I was in graduate school, our professor told the story that back in the day, these cross-country kids, just like in Texas, they'd go out and run all summer long. This one high school runner, in fact, it was his son, he ran for so long without water, he actually damaged his hypothalamus. And for the rest of his entire life, he never had that repaired. So we really want to be on the front end of looking at how we get prepared for races.
Yeah, as you're sharing all that, Kurt, I think to Ironman Coeur d'Alene several years ago, I was on site cheering on Trout athletes. You were there, you were racing. It was a hot one. And Trout ambassador Jonathan Brooks, who I know decently well. I'm fairly confident he wouldn't mind me sharing this story. But Jonathan Brooks actually DNF'd that day. He was one of many who DNF'd that day because of the heat. And when we caught up to him later, we were talking to him. He noticed while he was running that his body had stopped producing sweat entirely. Now, Jonathan Brooks is a medical doctor by trade. So he recognized immediately this is not okay. Pulled himself out of the race, you know, got the attention that he needed, and he became an Ironman several months later at Ironman Florida. So his story has a happy ending. But in his body changed based on the way he was hot, the way he was sweating. Now, Caleb, your first time on the podcast, this is not a question on our script, so I'm just gonna throw you a curveball straight at the gate. But you live in Texas, like I live in Texas, and so for you personally, Have you had a race that you went into it maybe not quite as prepared for the heat as you thought? And if so, how did that affect the way your body felt during that race?
Oh, for sure. I do a race every year in Central Texas. It's Tri-Waco. And
yeah,
it's July in July. Race in Texas. They moved it to June this year.
Okay.
But yes, so that is a very hot race every year. Last year, it was, or the 2 years ago, it was about 90 degrees during the run in the morning. And I was just seeing stars, stopping at every aid station. But that was a much hotter race than expected. And the year before, it had rained. So we had just got suckered in the year before of cool weather. So definitely was underprepared for that race.
Yeah, and so you started feeling it in the run. You just, your vision wasn't normal, and yeah, and that's obviously a sprint or Olympics, so you're pushing really hard until you get to the finish line. So now, I'm sure you guys have seen, like I have, like on social media, several of the pros, especially the ones who qualify for Kona before they go to Kona, several of our age group friends who sign up for a hot race, you'll see them start posting on the Facebook and on the Instagram, you know, these pictures themselves training in a bathroom with a heater on, or you know, going for a long run in the middle of the day when the sun is highest and as hot as it can be. And you'll see them talking about, oh, I'm heat training for such and such. And so I'm just curious. I mean, some of it is kind of intuitive, but when an athlete says I'm heat training, you know, when we say we're going out and trying to build our body's tolerance to the heat, what is actually happening in our body that improves our ability to handle a hot race? Caleb.
When the body hits about 101.3, we start to produce that more plasma that Kurt was talking about. And that plasma delivers oxygen via hemoglobin in the red blood cells. So when the ratio of the red blood cells to plasma gets off, the body wants to have them in balance. So then it's going to create more blood cells, red blood cells, and that's going to increase your overall blood volume. So that extra blood volume helps increase your oxygen capacity, and then as well as your cooling capacity. So some people may call it water weight, but you're just increasing your body's overall capacity and efficiency to cool itself in hot temperatures.
Yeah, no, totally makes sense. And definitely goes hand in hand with what Kurt was saying right at the start of the main set. And basically what we're here to learn today is, how do we do this? You know, what are the protocols? How do we do this safely? Obviously, we have to expose ourselves to some hot temperatures. And Kurt, I'm sure with your history in this sport, you've probably raced more hot races than Caleb and I combined, times two to the fourth power. That's some crude, you know, back of the napkin math. But the point is, you have some serious racing time spent, you know, both between you and the athletes you coach when it comes to hot days. So Kurt, what should a heat training protocol look like to make those physiological adaptations Caleb's talking about?
Yeah, and I think this is another question that I think that so many people can get on social media. And what I've found with heat training, I think some people get a little bit more, say, assertive or aggressive, so they don't take those gradual baby steps. So that is kind of the first thing to do, is definitely use common sense. I think where people struggle with heat training, they go to an extreme. For example, maybe they're doing an indoor training session, the air temperature might be 75, they shut the fan off and they crank it up to maybe 100 or 105. If that happens, I know it's not going to be a good experience for them and it's going to be miserable. It's kind of counterproductive. So I think the first thing I would suggest is definitely start gradually. The other thing is that when you think of our workout, especially in Tri-Dot, if you're just doing a recovery ride for say an hour, hour and a half, that might be a good session to start with some heat training. In other words, put on an extra shirt, cut the fan off, and get used to that. The worst thing you can do is say, hey, I'm totally in. I'm going to try my next FTP. I'll turn the heat up to 95. I will have no fan on, and I'm going to wear three shirts. Now, that would be fatal. So I think, again, just increase the intensity slowly. The next thing is that knowing that you're going to do a heat training session, I think it's just really paramount to think about it. What's happening during the session? You're really trying to sweat a lot more. So think about your hydration going into that session. Think about your electrolytes. Think about what you're doing during that session. And then think about after the session. I know I did a 90-minute hot yoga yesterday, getting ready for Ironman Texas. It was 113 degrees. There were 25 people in that room. I had a really plan on the front end. I barely made it to the finish, and the rest of the day I was wiped out. So I think that's another thing that you want to be mindful of. And then the next element is actually using your emotional intelligence as an athlete, that you're coaching yourself during an actual event. Your coach can be in your head, but they're not running alongside you. Think about your self-control and self-awareness. You've got to be aware of what's going on. Like you said, Andrew, you told the story. The person knew something wasn't right. I think so many people, they get caught up in the race. They're not checking themselves. You have to be very intuitive. I go back to that day in Coeur d'Alene, Andrew, I remember vividly. When I was on that second loop on the bike, my heart rate was actually going up higher than my power. There was like an inverse relationship. I'm going, wait a minute, I'm not at 180 watts anymore. I'm dropping down to 120. I'm out of salt. I felt like a newbie. I just ran out. Every person I went by, I'm like, oh, excuse me. Do you have any extra salts or things that I need? So I want to go ahead and suggest that to people. Use your emotional intelligence. The other thing, too, is that think about your consistency. So it's like a weekend warrior. I'm just going to do this one crazy heat training session for 6 hours and I'm going to crush it. It's better actually to stretch that out over a period of, say, 3 to 4 weeks and maybe start with 2 times a week, maybe 3 times a week. The other thing is make sure that gradual cool down. That is really going to be key as you're finishing that, to let your body cool down. And in doing that, that's going to make a big difference. I think the other thing is, we already know, but I want to reinforce that, is try to do your best to run midday. It's not glamorous. It's not fun. It's not enjoyable, but you're going to pay your tuition. That way, if you can do those off the bike runs in the afternoon, that's going to be key. The other thing too, that the benefit of Tri-Dot in our community, there's so many resources out there. There's actually sauna studios now, Caleb, you've probably heard of these, called Hot Works.
Yeah.
Where it's like a franchise.
Yeah.
That you can rent it out for like an hour and just have a suffer fast. So I think what we did back in the day compared to now, it makes it a little bit easier, but the more prep you can do on the front end, it's going to make a world of difference. And again, ideally, I would say in the range of, say, 3 to 5 weeks.
Now, Kurt, you mentioned in that wonderful explanation, a lot of good stuff in there for athletes to learn from. But you mentioned hot yoga, and I got to point that out. You were on a Tri-Dot podcast episode where we talked about yoga for the full hour. And I'm curious, Kurt, for our triathletes listening, when we talk about doing like a heat training session and going out of our way to do, like you said, a run in the middle of the day, so it's in the heat, you know, does things like hot yoga, does things like mowing your lawn for an hour on a Saturday when it's hot, like, does that all help, or does it need to be an actual like fitness session to help our bodies produce more plasma, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I think if you separate the specificity and just look at, you know, what's going on when your body is in that heat situation, it's going to be the same response. For me, when I did that yoga session yesterday, I actually did about an hour and 10 minute run before, and then I went right into the hot yoga. So if I add an hour and a half to an hour and 10, I really stretch out that duration. Now, it did take me almost the rest of the day. I was tempted to get on a bike for a recovery ride for about an hour. I'm like, wait a minute, I've got to get hydrated up. So I think, to answer the question for our listeners, if you can be specific, that's really good. But I go back to the intensity and the duration. Most people cannot do a heat training session for 3 to 4 hours. That's a little bit too demanding. But if you can slice it off to be, hey, let's go 15 minutes, let's go 30, let's go 45, let's go to an hour, I think after 2 to 3 hours, you're going to get into that danger zone.
Now, Caleb, for you, I know with the athletes you coach and for yourself personally, you're using some fairly new to newish tech. It's not brand new. It's been out for a little bit, but you are using the core body temperature sensor. And I have had the pleasure to chat with the team from Core. They're really great guys and have some really interesting technology for sure. How are you using this to help your athletes adapt to certain temperatures in their training?
Yeah. So I provide all of my premium athletes the Core body temp sensor because I believe in it so strongly. So it pairs with your watch and your bike computer to show you the real-time accurate reading of your core body temperature as well as the skin temperature. The core assigns 5 zones: hypothermia, normal, performance, power decline, and heat stress. So the actual sweet spot for heat training is your core threshold, which is high zone 3 or low zone 4. For most people, that's about 100.9 to 101.7 Fahrenheit, or freedom units. When heat training, it, like Kurt said, it isn't always better to go into zone, like more is not better. We want to stay in that heat zone. So knowing where you're at in that core threshold zone is almost impossible without something telling you what your actual core temperature is. So the more you know, the more specific you can be about intentional training.
And so you put that on while you're doing the training session. Is it all training sessions, heat training sessions specifically?
You can use it for all training sessions. It goes on your heart rate monitor, or you can put it on a sticky that you can actually leave the adhesive on your chest somewhere for multiple days at a time. The battery can last over a week, I believe, of full-time continuous monitoring.
Yeah, no, very cool. And so for you and your athletes, you're actually taking stock, you're actually taking a measurement of what your body temperature is doing during a session, throughout a session, and how are you using that to kind of judge where you are in terms of being ready for a hotter event?
Right. So everybody's different. So you need to see what your body reaction is to this specific core temperature. So someone that thrives in the heat may be able to get up to 102.5 Fahrenheit and still be able to push harder. Whereas me, I fall more in the typical range to where after 101.5, I'd want to get off the course and go get in an ice bath. So it's incredibly important to know how your body reacts to the temperatures outside. Core also has a heat strain index, which it takes into consideration your skin temperature as well as your core temperature and heart rate to give you basically the perceived heat exertion. Your body will be able to easily wick away heat if it's 70 degrees outside. Even if you have a high core temperature, it's not perceived to be a high heat strain. Whereas if it's 100 outside and your skin temperature is 98, then your body's going to have a much harder time to wick away that heat and cool itself off.
Definitely cool. And Caleb, definitely something I wanted to hear about, because it is something that our athletes, you know, one-on-one can buy and play with and monitor for themselves and do some individual learnings in the meantime. And maybe one day we'll see it fully integrated with TriDot. We'll see. But I'm curious about this one, guys. And Kurt, we'll go to you here. How long does it take for our body to adjust to a hotter climate? You know, we've talked about, you mentioned doing a certain duration, building up to where you're able to handle doing it longer and longer, getting in the heat a couple times per week. Is this something that we need to do from like the day we sign up for our Ironman or our sprint or our Olympic or whatever it is? Or is this something that we really need to do for a couple day, couple week concentrated period? How long does it take for our body to actually become heat adapted?
Yeah, you know, Andrew, it's at that safe response of it really kind of depends, but I'll give you various examples. I think the important thing for our listeners to do is to take stock. I mean, know self and be very objective. If you're not sure, ask someone that you train with, ask your significant other, they will tell you right away. So let's say, for example, if Andrew, in a nice way, can we use you?
Yeah, please do. Go
okay.
For it.
Okay, we will. You are in Texas. Chances are you're much more acclimated because of your day-to-day activities, including swimming, biking, running, taking care of the family. You're going to be at a much better advantage as compared to someone that's up in the Pacific Northwest or up in Canada, where the weather is much, much cooler. So I think that's the first thing you want to do. And like I said, some people, they thrive in the heat. The other people I know as a coach, I know them, and it's like, no, that's not going to be your race. I just had someone do Boston. It got up to about 73 degrees, and the athlete let me know the last 6 miles, was very difficult because just that temperature rise was really tough on them. But I think generally speaking, to play it safe, if a person is doing a 70.3, I would go with about a 3 to 5 week protocol. I think that's a really good safe, you know, you've got to build in that training plan too as an athlete, or do that with your coach, is just start building that in. I think 3 to 5 weeks is good for a 70.3. If it's your A race and you're going to go big, let's say, for example, Kona is probably the best example, I'd probably push that out to about 8 weeks. The other thing that the athlete wants to remember is they sign up for a race and they anticipate heats. You have to ask yourself this, is it just a dry heat, for example, Arizona? Is it going to be hot and humid like, say, Texas? That's what they need to know. Is it going to be like, is it going to be hot and at high elevation? And probably, Andrew, I don't think you're at this race. It was Boulder, and I want to say that was in 2018. I think when I got off the bike, it was actually 102 degrees. And it was at 5,000 feet in elevation.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate that I was able to train in a ski resort in Southern California to simulate, because that radiant sun is just incredibly hot.
Yeah, it's different.
It's much different. And then if you shift over to the Big Island, as you know, Andrew, you've got multiple factors. You've got heat, you've got wind, you have humidity, but you have something called black lava. That you can't simulate that unless you're actually there. But it has to be very specific heat training for the event you're going to do. But I know if I do the backward mapping from October, I will definitely ramp things up to, say, August, September. Those are 2 months right there where I'm doing a lot of stuff in the afternoon outside to try to simulate that heat of Kona. So I'm really giving myself more room. If you do it any shorter, I feel bad for some people. They're busy. They're working. They show up like on Wednesday. Or Andrew, you've seen this in Kona. They fly in on Tuesday. You don't want to say it, but you want to say it. It's like you are going to have a really tough time on Saturday because your body is just going, oh my goodness, what have you done to me?
Great stuff there, Kurt. Just to think through, what race are you doing? What type of heat are you entering into? What was the elevation? And, you know, definitely making sure you're taking the time to get prepared. Now there are some ways and some things that you can do to prepare for a hot race that don't have anything to do with the training itself, right? That there's things like figuring out your hydration strategy, figuring out your cooling protocols. Getting ready for my first Ironman, I was doing all sorts of things on my long runs, trying to see if a wet bandana here or a wet t-shirt there, or a towel in my socks there, in my hat there, you know, what's going to make me feel the coolest. And so I was playing with the cooling protocols. And then there's skin protection, right? There's whether or not you're using sunscreen, whether or not you're using any sort of sleeves or bucket hats or whatever, you know, all those things can be really helpful to figure out in your training before you get into a scorcher of a race. So Caleb, when you're talking your athletes through going into a hot event, you know, how much are you talking about these types of things?
I would say this is a cornerstone of heat training, especially knowing your sweat rate and not just knowing it for one temperature. You need to know it for a variety of temperatures and different levels of humidity. Like, say, if you go to Kona, it's going to be completely different than St. George. St. George has no humidity. It just wicks right off of you. It's amazing when we did the ambassador camp there. But you need to know what those rates are so you can adequately plan your hydration. You need to know your sodium loss rate per liter so that you can replenish that accurately. As far as cooling strategies, a lot of those are very personally dependent. So some people love a good sun guard, but to other people, it'll just trap in heat. Same goes for a cap versus a visor. Most people have probably seen the pros racing in Singapore, and the T100 series have those weird headbands.
Yeah.
It's a headband that has these little heat sinks in it, and it cools whenever you pour water on it or just with air passing over it. It's really cool, but you got to know if that's going to work for you or not. Some people would still prefer to have the hat that you can put ice in. It also depends on whether you like ice in your hands, in your kit, where in your kit. Do you put it
anywhere,
in your mouth?
Caleb. I'll put it anywhere.
I agree with you, but I suggested some people put it down the front of their kit and they had quite a reaction of disapproval. So this is definitely one of those things you want to practice before race day, just like anything else. But the one thing that everyone should do is sunscreen, because skin cancer is no joke.
Yeah. And actually, it's on my short list of things to do a full length episode about is skincare for triathletes. Definitely some things to consider there. Kurt Madden, as you're, I mean, you've done Ultraman in Hawaii, that which is a step longer than Ironman. You know, you're no stranger to figuring out your own heat protocols and hydration strategies. You know, what do you tell your athletes here on just ways to get ready for the heat that don't necessarily have to do with training in the heat?
Yeah. You know, some people don't think about it, but actually when we're in the water, depending upon the water temperature, you can actually overheat. It's funny when you talk to people.
Yeah.
It might be 74 and they're going, oh my goodness, I've got to actually stop and unzip my wetsuit. Okay, because I'm getting so hot. Other people are like, oh my gosh, I'm cold at 74. Throw another wetsuit on me. Can I wear booties? So it really varies from person to person. But let's hold on to that thought for a second. Because if, depending upon where you live, I know that I'm fortunate that I can get into a pool, say at the YMCA, where the lap pool is maybe 78 degrees. However, for some older people that do exercises, I go in that warm pool. And oh my goodness, I think the water in there is like 88. And if I want to wake up call and get humbled, like on my 100 repeats, if I'm in the lap pool, I'm at a zone two, I'm going like 130, 130, 130. I go in there, I do about four or five, and I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. I'm hitting like 138 and it's only been 15 minutes, but I can just feel my heart rate. I can just feel it up. I'm not hitting zone two anymore. I'm in zone one. But see that idea right there? It's like, wait a minute. Maybe I should swim where the older folks swim. And no hit on old people. But I think you've got to think about that in the swim, because as you're swimming and you're losing water, I mean, I was thinking about this too, that if you're in, say, a full Ironman, you get out in 120, that you're losing water. But if you're in the water for like an hour and 45 or an hour and 50 minutes, every time you exhale, you're beginning more dehydrated. That's another 30 minutes right there. So
you
I think
that
that's
sun
something.
Beating down on
oh,
your
yeah.
back.
Yeah. Every time you exhale, you're losing water. So if you looked at two different people, the one that came out 120 and the one that came out 150, the one that came out 150 definitely has lost a lot more water because they're breathing. And that's something that we've got to think about. So that's the first thing that people can do, is just think about, hey, maybe I should go ahead and try to get in a warmer pool. I know some people, depending upon where they're set up, they could actually swim with a wetsuit to be a little bit warmer in the water. That's the first thing they can do right there. And then again, I think as Caleb has touched on, the athlete needs to think about the nutritional plan and at the same time understand the electrolyte plan. For example, if you're going into a very hot race like Texas or another place, your focus should probably be more dialed in on the electrolytes. That's going to be the most important thing or the limiting factor as compared to, I've got to kind of train my gut to get in 300 to 400 calories per hour. Because when your body gets hot like that, your body's going to start to shut down a little bit. So focus on those electrolytes. And I think the other thing we've already mentioned, but just making sure that you're looking at your nutritional plan, your electrolyte plan, to make sure that you are good to go as you're getting ready for that. And I know that, and you're going back to the Ultraman, as I prepared for this, I thought about it. So day three is a 6.2 mile swim, 90 mile bike ride, 6,000 vertical feet or whatever. Day two is 175 mile bike ride. But on day three, as we got prepared for the last time I did it in 2019, it's that double marathon from Hawaii back to Kona. And you've been out there on that highway and it takes no prisoners at all. When we prepared that event, my crew, Andre Wagner and my son and Rick, her boyfriend, they actually got 50 pounds of ice. Now we weren't having a party. 50 pounds of ice. And like Caleb said, about every 10 minutes, they were jumping out of that van. They would just give me a handful of ice in a baggie in this hand, one in the other, one down my shorts. And 10 minutes later, guess what happened? They'd be right back out with another one just to keep my temperature cool, sucking on ice. So you can never over-prepare when you're looking at protocols to make sure that your body is going to be cool.
Now, depending on the time of your race, the location of your race, it might not be possible for you physically to get outside and have it be hot before race day, or maybe it might be hot where you are, but it's not the Kona heat or the type of heat you're going to encounter on your race day. And you guys have touched on wearing some layers, doing some training inside, doing some training where it's hot, and then doing hot yoga afterwards. So I think we've touched on this a little bit, but I want to hear if there's anything else that you guys have to say when it comes to an athlete out there who knows, I've got a big race coming up. It's going to be hot. It's not hot where I live. How do I get ready for this? Coach Kirk, what would you say?
I would say on this, the athlete, no matter where they are in the spectrum, if they're kind of a newbie or a neophyte, if they're kind of a mid-packer, they're really on the upper end, they really need to mark specific heat training workouts as they build up to that. I mean, that's just, it's kind of common sense that we can forget because we're so busy doing other things. So that is something that people really, really need to be aware of, is just pinpointing those. And like I've touched on earlier, you want to be very gradual in the nature of doing this. I would start with some recovery sessions to make it easy and then continue to ramp those things up.
Great word there, Kurt. Now, Caleb, curious to hear this from you. You know, we all obviously want to see progress from the hard work that we're putting in. We want to see that as we're getting in the heat from week to week to week, that we're improving our tolerance for the heat from week to week to week. Is there any way to measure that improvement or to see signs of the fact that we're improving our tolerance for the heat?
Well, yeah, perceived effort is a pretty big indicator in itself. If you go out in similar conditions at the start of your heat training versus at the end of your heat or during your heat training, it should be able to feel noticeably easier for the same pace. However, you can also quantitatively do a test. Indoors is the easiest way to control it. Set it at a temperature inside and do a specific workout. Compare your data from today's workout versus the one you did at the start of the heat training. You should be able to either hold a higher power or be able to control the heart rate drift later on in the workout. So the heart rate drift is being able to have your power and heart rate at the same level.
I think, again, when we're trying to look at, you know, your hard work and everything you're putting in, what are some of those responses? And I think, you know, to piggyback off of what Caleb is, the athlete needs to be a little bit more mindful when they go into these sessions. In other words, they need to have some metrics they're looking at, kind of pre and post. And if they did it over, say, a 2 to 3 month period, that would be great. The first thing, you want to be real consistent. Let's say, for example, even if you're inside on a treadmill, let's call it an hour and a half run. Everyone can relate with that. So what you want to do is you want to notice over time, if you're doing that same session with the same main set that is similar, take a look at your heart rate during that session and see that if you're going to have less of that increase. If you're not having that increase, you know, your body's starting to adapt to you know, that session that you are getting heat adapted. I think that's important. And then again, just looking at your sweat, you know, looking at your cooling of the skin. I think that's another key indicator. You can do that by weighing in before or weighing after, but you can see how much you're actually sweating. I think the other thing too is that, like Caleb said, a lot of this is mental. But if your rate of perceived effort, it's like it feels a lot easier on getting used to this. Your body is adapting. I think that mental aspect is really, really key. The other thing too, and I notice this, if I try to swim later in the day after a long run, you're having less cramping and symptoms of heat exhaustion. You don't feel dizzy. You don't feel like you have a headache. You can actually hold a decent conversation. So those are multiple measures that all of our listeners should really focus in on too, that it's very serious. Be very diligent about your notes and make sure you're tracking that, as compared to it's very, very random. I think when things are random like this, it's not going to, the end product's not going to be very good.
Now, early on in the episode, we talked about how, I mean, this can be a dangerous thing, right? Like, it can be a dangerous thing to take on a hot event and not be ready for it. It can be a dangerous thing to put yourself out there in the heat and overheat and not be prepared for that in a training session. So when we're out there, you know, what are some signs that our body is starting to get dangerously hot so we can all have our head on a swivel, be on the lookout and be taking self-inventory during these workouts of, hey, am I still okay? Or am I getting a little out of control and I need to shut this workout down? Caleb, what would you say to our athletes today on this, on just what are some signs that maybe we need to call it quits a little early or back the intensity down a little bit?
Well, actually, the easy answer is just to look down at your core. So if you do have one of the core sensors, just pay attention to it. And it's a great lesson. Took me 3 marathons to learn that when it's hot outside, don't just run off of feeling. Look and see what your core is doing. Because if you're running at a pace that you should be able to do, but you plan on doing it in 60-degree weather and it's 80 degrees, your core is not going to be the same temperature. Tridot has the environment normalized ability, and we need to pay attention to it. But signs and symptoms, we went over earlier in the episode, but if you're starting to feel faint or getting dizzy, if anything's starting to tingle, especially in the extremities, if it goes numb, then definitely stop and get medical attention. These can be very serious problems, and they can turn from bad to worse very quickly.
Yeah, and we're here, and we're, you know, about 40 minutes or so into a conversation about the heat, and Caleb is just now dropping Tridot's and VioNorm technology into the conversation, and I knew it would come up eventually. I knew it would come up somewhere, and I was going to make sure it came up if it didn't. So, hats off to Caleb for bringing up eNorm, and eNorm, you know, it doesn't heat adapt us. What eNorm does is it makes sure whatever session you're doing, the temperature you're doing that session in, your paces adjust for the temperature. So if I'm going to do a session on the track at 6 a.m. when it's nice and a great temperature outside, my run paces might be a little more aggressive. But if I can't get out there and I tell Tridot, hey, I'm going to do this session later this afternoon when it's hotter, it's going to back my run paces down accordingly to make sure I'm working as hard as I'm supposed to be working in the session. And so that's always super nice to know. And I found it to be a wonderful tool, especially here in Texas, to know that the session I'm doing it at the right intensity. And then obviously the wisdom from our coaches today is kind of the extra know-how in terms of getting yourself ready to be in the heat for a race itself. Coach Kurt, what would you like to add?
Yes, you opened up the door, Andrew, so I'm going to come back.
Come on in.
Come on in. Let's go. Yeah, I think also in addition to your normalized training stress, and I think that's, you know, really, really, that's the hallmark of Tridot. We know that. But really, the athlete should spend some time on race X and have a really objective view with someone else, not what you want, but your reality of where you are right now. I think it can be very humbling. And I think on that note, they want to look at the course. For example, if we look at a multi-loop course, Texas could be the example that you're going to do three loops. And you know that maybe if you're near the front, that first loop, it's not going to be too crowded. But you get into that second loop and that third loop, and all of a sudden you've got 3,000 plus racers out there. And that run walk protocol that we've talked about, game changer, because what's going to happen when you start to walk? Okay, you've got that ice, you're getting your core temperature down, you're going to be okay. Then you start to shuffle, then you start to run, and you run and walk. That is so, so much better for the athlete to do in their training. That's going to carry over to the race versus I am bound and determined, I'm going to run every single step 26.2 miles. That might not be the most efficient way, because I'm always thinking as an athlete, even as a coach, if I can get my heart rate down 3 to 4 beats more, to me, that's like big, big money. If I can stay in a zone 2, because I know, Andrew, I go back to Kona, I always tell people, if you really want an insane workout, I want you to go to a Leahy Drive in October, and I want you to do mat shuttles for an hour on a Leahy Drive.
No, thank you.
Yes. Thanks. Now, you know your heart rate. You won't even be in zone 2. You're going to start in zone 3. I mean, because it's just that heat and there's no air and it's just so humid. But I think that's really, really important as people are looking at that they've really got to be aware. And Caleb touched on it. They've got a headache. They're confused. They're dizzy. They're not right. And actually, when people are out there as volunteers with the medical staff, they're there to help you. They don't want to pull you from the race, but if you can't say your name or what state am I in or what time of the day it is, you're not in a good place. And it's better to say, I need some help.
Well, let's not end the episode talking about potentially DNFing or withdrawing because you're getting overheated. Pay attention to that. We want you to be safe out there on course. But let's end the episode today with some good stories. You guys both coach a lot of athletes, and I just want to hear, to wrap up our main set today, one story from each of you of an athlete you worked with where specifically a part of the conversation with the race they had coming up was their heat training protocol. And just walk us through what the target race was, what you did working with that athlete in their training to make sure they were ready for the race day, and then how did that hot race day go? We'll start with Caleb. We'll go to Kurt. Caleb, take it away.
So actually, one of my athletes did try Waco with me last year. It's that race in Central Texas during July where it is
hot.
I mean, it's hot. The water temperature is mid to high 80s. So at that temperature, you can't even hardly wear a wetsuit or a swim skin. I mean, wetsuits are completely illegal.
Out of the question.
Swim skins are unrecommended. Your body just can't cool down from the start. So we practiced finding an outdoor pool that as hot as we could find and swim in that at least once a week. Bikes were done indoors with the fans off and runs were done in the heat of the day. And we had both done this race 2 years in a row. So he was able to go 30 seconds per mile faster than the year before with implementing these training heat protocols. And he was much happier with his result at the end of the race too. So
the good thing, Caleb, on getting faster in the heat is you get off the course a little bit sooner. You get out of the heat a little bit sooner. You get to those chocolate milks and water bottles and electrolyte beverages and the coolers a little bit sooner. So yeah,
as long as they're iced down.
As long as they're iced down. Coach Kirk, close us down. What's a good heat training story from one of your athletes?
Yeah, I'm probably going to go with Chris Plant. And Chris Plant is a Canadian. She's up in Ottawa. And she's a good example that she doesn't live in Texas. But bless her heart, she has a full-time job. And she is dedicated to do whatever she can for heat training. So she trains indoors like 90% of the time. So like Caleb said, everything that we've talked about, she just, again, she pays her tuition as she goes. She goes in the school of hard knocks. She'll, again, make those adaptions internally when she's on the bike. She'll do the same thing when she's on the run. Swimming, not so much. But Chris is very intentional. She'll get to Kona early. She's very easy to work with, to hang out with. So we'll get out on the course every morning. We'll get out there and swim to make sure we get some nice salty water in our mouth and we experience all the waves down there by the pier. And then we'll actually go out on the course and we'll go Javi and various sections to get the hottest and the windiest part of the course. And then really when we look out, say at the Energy Lab, I think people are actually, you can make and break it out there to really get out there at 2 or 3 in the afternoon to go, okay, we're going to do an hour and 20 minute run. And I think in doing that, what I've seen with Chris, remarkable story. Last year, she qualified at Ironman Texas. Then she had hip replacement surgery, I want to say within 3 weeks. No, this is hip replacement surgery. She had one done a few years ago, but she had the other one done. That way she's good on both sides. And she's like, Coach, I don't think I'm going to get to Kona. And I said, Chris, you're a fighter. You are bound and determined. You're stubborn. You're not going to give up. She slowly started to ramp up and ramp up and ramp up and ramp up. Before you know it, I had a sense like, Chris, you are going to be just fine. She gets to Kona 3 weeks early. We do the same thing. I think she finished right around 13 and a half hours. And she's so pumped. She's so excited that she's already talking about Kona for, say, possibly 2026. She's already got that on her radar. And I know her. That if I had a role model, someone inspires me, I get worked up about anything. It's like, no, she is the best example. She will pay the piper and do things that are just insane. But on race day, she enjoys it and her body is adapted. So shout out to Chris Plant.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
It's Coach Cool Down Tip Time, and I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. Joining me on the cool down, all the way from the UK, is professional coach and manager of the Precision Race Team, Will Usher. Will has been coaching triathlon for over 25 years and works with beginners all the way to professionals, both able-bodied and paratriathletes. He is a well-seasoned athlete himself, having raced all distances internationally for Great Britain age group and even hitting the podium at world level. Will currently lives in Godalming with his wife, Rhea, two young children, Lucy and Thomas, their dog, Poppy, and cat, Ember. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, I hear that you love to surf. So what is the best wave that you have ever caught? I want all the details, like where, when, who, everything.
Well, I mean, first things first, I have to caveat that I'm a pretty average, below average surfer. Yeah, I mean, probably this 8 foot waving in Cornwall on Portsmouth Beach, which is where we go on holiday quite a lot. And I dropped in late on a longboard and I was absolutely convinced I was going to get dumped. Somehow I stuck it and I was so far back over the back of the board trying to keep the nose up. Like, I literally have no idea I was that flexible still. and you know, I suppose fear is a good motivator. Anyway, the rush was awesome. And I nearly fell off once I'd actually got stuck with the wave because I was so surprised that I was still there, you know? But yeah.
Well, I think that you are not average if you can catch and stay on an 8-foot wave. Just saying.
I don't know. It's either you know, get on it or get dumped. So it's strong motivation. Yeah.
Nothing like that for motivation. So I have a hard time believing that you actually fall into the average category with anything that you do. So let's hear a superstar tip that you have for our listeners today.
Sure. So, and this is something that we see quite a lot of, and it's a super good way of ensuring that you get the most out of your training. And that's basically the use of your metrics, right? So everybody knows that there's basically three principal metrics: power, pace, and heart rate. And typically for a high intensity session, you can only really look at power or pace because your heart rate has that lag behind it and it will never get into place in time. So say, for example, you had three blocks of 6 minutes with 1 minute in between, you'd be lucky if your heart rate's in the right zone by the last minute of each six, even if it gets there on the first rep. So we use power and pace very specifically to make sure you're hitting intensity. However, many of you will have noticed that there's a nice zone two block at the back end of that session. And where I'm talking about the use of metrics here is that we use power and pace in the high intensity, but whilst in order to get your training score to 100, you still need to be within your range for your zone two range on terms of pace or power, whatever it might be, but really pay attention to the heart rate because whereas at the beginning of the session, you'd have comfortably been in your zone two warm-up, would comfortably have been at the bottom of your zone two heart rate, most likely now, and probably quite close to the top end of the pace for the zone two. But now you'll be the other way around. It's going to take a little while for your heart rate to calm down, and you really need to focus. And the likelihood it is, you're going to need to reduce the pace. And there's a temptation to push the pace on because you're enjoying running fast and you want to get X amount of kilometers or miles done. But, you know, really pay attention, switch that thought process to the heart rate, because the reason we have zone two and zone four is to push the threshold and your upper end of your capability. And zone two is the cardiac efficiency, cardiovascular efficiency. And if you fall into the middle trap, the zone three area, you're really not doing anything particularly well and you're missing the point of that side of the session.
That is excellent and something that a lot of us need to pay attention to and to listen to. I think that a lot of us get into that definite trap of pushing too hard in the easy stuff and not pushing hard enough in the hard stuff. So when you are in that zone two at the end of your session, you had said that you're not really paying attention to that pace or power. So if your heart rate is still lower, then is it okay to push a little bit faster or a little bit harder on the pace and power?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, let's say you have a range in your pace between a 5:30-minute kilometer and a 6-minute kilometer, right, for your zone two. So you've got a 30-second band with which you can or range that you can work in. You just need to make sure that your heart rate, say your heart rate was, and I'm a really high beta, so I can go up to 162 at the upper end of my zone two, but I need to make sure that I'm in the around 150s area comfortably. And if I'm holding and it's sticking there nicely, then yeah, I can afford to increase the pace. But the important thing is not to go over the top of your zone two heart rate. So work to whatever pace you can within your zone two pace range. Because you've got to get that training score.
Right.
But, you know, if you need to work, you can work harder if you want, but don't go over into zone three, basically, for the heart rate perspective. And it will be much harder after you've done the intervals to stick in that range. So you're going to have to run considerably slower than you or bike considerably slower than you thought you would.
Yeah, that's wonderful to listen to. If your heart rate is lower, do you think that maybe you didn't push hard enough in those zone four efforts earlier on in the workout?
I'd say that, you know, probably you're just getting more efficient. And what is staggering, it shouldn't be, but because Tri-Dot layers itself so beautifully, what you will find is that as you near the end of a cycle, just before the week before you're doing your new test week or whatever, what you'll typically find is that you're able to run or get your heart rate down quite quickly after the threshold work, and that you can run at the upper end of your zone two band, and you're like, you know, okay, I'm feeling really great. And then you do your test and you drop like 30 seconds during 5K. You're like, oh, this is awesome. And then you look at the new speed, you're like, there's no way I'm going to be able to hold my heart rate there. But suddenly, magically, you do. Because of how beautifully layered the training is, it allows you to do that. But that's super important, because ultimately that zone two efficiency is what's going to carry you through race day. Right. I've seen some of my athletes improve a minute per kilometer on their zone two pace for 15 beats lower, right, in terms of their heart rate. Now, if we scale that up and apply that across the disciplines, what we're saying is over a marathon, that's 42 minutes, right, which is enormous. It's we've got to look after the efficiency of the heart, and we do the relevant parts of the session for the different reasons.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.